Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Today, we are here with Professor Manuela Ciotti, and we are here to discuss her very famous work, Retro-Modern India, Forging the Low-Caste Self. So let me briefly introduce Professor Manuela to you all. Professor Manuela is a professor of the Social and Cultural Anthropology of the Global South. She is a social anthropologist by training. She has worked on the areas of inequality, identity politics, and modernity in the struggle of social justice among subaltern communities in India. She has extensively engaged with ethnographic fieldwork and archival research. Some of her major work includes Retro-Modern India, that was published in 2010 by Routledge Publication. Her other major works include Unsettling the Archetypes, Femininities and Masculinities in Indian Politics, that came out in 2017 by Women Unlimited. There are other works as well. Some of her forthcoming works include Unmooring the Nation, The Global Spread of Modern and Contemporary Art from India. It is upcoming from Indiana University Press. And from Routledge, her work on political agency and gender in India is also upcoming. So welcome, Manuela, to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your generous introduction, Kalyani.
Yeah. So before we begin the conversation around your book, let me introduce your book to the audience. The book is an interesting engagement with Chamar identity and understanding it through the lens of modernity. Through a rich ethnographic engagement and field-based data, the book has looked into what modernity has meant for Chamar community and also the dialectical relationship such identity formation had with the discourse of modernity itself. So let me begin the discussion around this book. So Manuela, your work is an important intervention to understand the paradigm of modernity per se and how Chamar identity can be located within this paradigm. What made you think to work on Chamar community from Manipur village at first place? Also, if you can reflect on how uniquely you position your research to understand Chamar community within the existing modernity discourse.
That's great, Kalyani. These are incredible, incredibly important questions. Thank you so much. Maybe I would like to start with the sort of the question about selecting, you know, this community to then, you know, sort of going on and making these interventions on modernity and I mean, primarily. And for our non-Indian audience, Chamar community is basically part of the larger Dalit population in India, and so that's very important to locate this community first, and the community in question that belongs to this caste and with whom I worked, you know, is situated in the very large state of Uttar Pradesh in the north of India, and this basically. My field work actually started in the late 1990s, and precisely in 98. And when I was thinking about this podcast, I realized that, you know, next year is going to be 25 years since I basically began this field work, which then the book is based on field work, which was conducted in between 98 and 2005, of course, with large breaks in between. And then I've actually visited, I've been visiting this, you know, this village over the years, and I'm very much in touch with the community, of course, with social media, and which is actually fantastic. So it's important to think also of the you know of the specific time an era during which, well, era, you know, the period of, you know, within Indian's political history. To then really understand, you know, the intervention that I've tried to make, became very prominent after, you know, years of you know, engagement with this community was sort of a process that had featured two main trends within it. The first one was this community's social transformation that really followed the trends of, you know, the Indian middle class and upper middle class, upper classes in the 19th century, in India's 19th century, which focused on, you know, the production of class distinctions, such as, for example, you know, an accent on women's respectability, on education, and this civilizing, you know, quote unquote, dimension of, you know, formal education. And at the same time, you know, this Dalit Chamar community has, of course, been politically mobilized with, you know, within Dalit parties such as the Bahujan Samaj Party that we probably return, you know, later on during our discussion. A party that was founded in the mid-80s, and then, of course, at the time I was doing my research, he was really, he had already ascended to great popularity, had been really quite successful at elections. And so I realized that there was a, you know, that I was basically photographing a process which featured these two seemingly, anyway, I mean, seemingly or just apparently conflicting trends, but that are actually coming together in very interesting ways within, you know, this community. So I've been looking at these trends, entanglements, at their tension, but also at the outcome somehow. And of course, the outcome is always in progress, right? Because we are talking about socio-economic, political, and cultural processes. And on the basis of this came my challenge to the very important paradigm of alternative modernities, for example, in the works by Dilip Gaonkar. This very important paradigm trying to account for you know, differences within national templates of modernity. And so it was very important to state, you know, the difference, you know, vis-a-vis Western models of modernity. And I think this intervention was extremely powerful and successful. With my book, I basically pushed this paradigm a little further because I was really interested in thinking about these national templates of modernity vis-a-vis societies that are deeply divided. And of course, with the caste system in India, you know, we have a model par excellence of this, you know, of these kinds of divisions. And so I was basically pushing forward pushing further the analysis of these templates of modernity to really understand what was happening within the nation, and especially in societies, as I said, that are deeply divided. And, you know, the caste system is, of course, a main engine, you know, that has historically created and reinforced these divisions. And so, more than looking at the differences between Western and Western worlds, I was really looking into the nation state. And from the standpoint of Dalit Chamar identity and agency. And so this would be, you know, to start our conversation, you know, this would be, you know, the book's main intervention. And I think it's important to state that the moment we foreground Dalit Chamar, you know, identity and agency, that's the moment where we understand that we need to change some things. Okay, so we no longer can talk about only national templates or, you know, the West, you know, against or vis-a-vis the non-West, but we really need to go deeper. And this is exactly what the book ended up doing, in a way. So I would think that this is, this could frame, sort of the rest of our, our conversation. And I think that the outcome of this intervention, or the driving principle, I would say, was really to build a more intimate connections between, you know, debates and concepts of modernity that were that been emerging from post-colonial worlds and their actors. But my book shows that actors are not all the same, right? And so the very fact of foregrounding, you know, a Dalit community, I think is really crucial in terms of understanding what we can do, you know, how we can build also on that and take it further. And, you know, we can discuss this in, in the course of this conversation. I hope that this is a good introduction, you know, to our debate, Kalyani.
Yeah. Oh, that's really reflective, Manvara. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And it's really interesting to... thank you, I'm audible?
Yes, you are.
So it's really interesting to understand the ways in which you have understood the very paradigm of modernity, not going with the very national template of modernity, but actually looking into an alternative modernity paradigm through the lens of caste. And it's also interesting the time when you were writing this book, such kind of imagination of caste was barely done. So a very pioneering work in that way. So let me begin with my second question, Manvara. In your study, you have indicated the difference between Ahir and Yadav kinship organization with that of Chamar community. Can you elaborate on this more? A follow-up question from this is, how do you investigate Bahujan identity, which discusses about coming together of caste marginal identities?
Yes, thank you. So these two questions are actually, are very much connected. And I would like to start with the second one. Again, also for our non-Indian audience, I just wanted to, explain what Bahujan, you know, sort of means. And Bahujan means the majority of the people. And the main Dalit party that I've mentioned earlier, the Bahujan Samaj Party, you know, would be translated as, you know, the majority of the society, you know, party. And in a way, this party wanted to really, you know, bring together all the oppressed, you know, lower caste people, not necessarily only Dalits, and in this kind of political organization, which I think to a certain extent, you know, and for a certain period of time, it did work. Even in the face of, you know, caste oppression, which is carried out by lower caste, not necessarily only by upper caste. And this is something that we need to bear in mind. But, you know, Bahujan is also, in my view, is also an aspirational construct, a hope that people will come together, whether in a party a formation or a movement, you know. And I, you know, especially during my second long-term field work in the Uttar Pradesh national, you know, capital, Lucknow, and this was, you know, an ethnography of Bahujan Samaj Party women activists, especially Dalit activists, you know, I could really see this, you know, Bahujan construct in a way, in action, right? So many people coming together from different caste communities, also different religious communities. And so this was, I think, a very special moment that, you know, where something could have been built, which could have lasted a little longer, you know, than what it actually sort of, you know, lasted. So I think that we need to keep in mind, you know, the issue of caste discrimination and violence that is also, you know, obviously concerning the relations between the lower caste and, you know, Dalit class. And, you know, Bahujan as a, again, a political aspiration, you know, a hope. And now I want to go back to your other question, because, so the first question about, you know, Ahir or Yadav kinship. Ahir and Yadav is a, you know, traditionally, you know, cowherds communities, again, also found in North India. And the specific argument that I made in my book about these communities, and that basically built on the very important work by Lucia Micheluti on these communities, same in the same state of Uttar Pradesh, is a basically, she's found that the Yadavs had really, you know, capitalized on the idiom of descent and kinship to actually trace their genealogies going back to, you know, Lord Krishna, right? And this was a way to create, you know, a political community, you know, through this very strong idiom of descent. And so caste substance is very much, you know, built through this idiom of descent. On the other hand, you know, to mobilize, you know, for political mobilization, this was something that was absolutely not present, you know, within Chamar community, but also at large, you know, within Dalit communities. Because basically, they would not really mobilize on an idiom of descent, or, you know, they would not really mobilize kinship, but they strongly believed in the ways in which education could change, could transform a very derogatory caste substance that obviously comes from, you know, the idiom of untouchability or purity and pollution that is, you know, the driving principle of the caste system, right? And in terms of you know, in lieu of genealogies, you know, within Dalit communities, you have, I mean, you know these things, you know, like a Dalit pantheon where all the most important figures, like, you know, the famous Dalit leader, Dr. Ambedkar, and others, you know, basically feature in that. And so it's a very different ways of understanding caste substance, and also to embrace political organizations and then to basically mobilize accordingly. So that was the main argument there. And you see, it's also very important to make these arguments because we are talking about communities that are, you know, living in the same regions, right? But you have very different ways to understand, you know, of the community to understand themselves, of mobilizing and, you know, and constructing those imagined communities upon which, you know, these political formations actually rest. So that was my, you know, that was my point. And of course, there have been, you know, some successful, I think, examples of the ways in which this Bahujan identity worked or could work, and some other less successful examples, I would say. And yes, and then we also have to consider, as I said earlier, you know, the difficult relations, you know, often between, you know, Dalit communities and other lower caste communities, I mean, non-Dalit lower caste communities. So it's a way to basically braid, you know, caste identities and practices with ways of, you know, envisioning themselves in the past, in the present, in the future, and thinking of how all of this informs political agency.
It's an interesting reflection on the both Ahir-Yadav kinship and Chamar kinship patterns, as well as their political and social engagement. So let me move on to the third question. Your work has also brought interesting reflection on BSP politics and its genesis. Can you discuss more about interaction of Chamar caste with other caste groups within party politics?
Yes, thank you. I think I've already started, you know, doing this when I mentioned my, you know, the example of, well, my ethnography field work in Lucknow. But of course, I can dwell on this further. I think it's good to go back to, you know, the specific times, the specific periods of my field work. As I said, you know, the Bahujan Samaj Party, as you know, was already quite popular and quite successful. At the time during my field work, I could trace the ways in which, especially the young educated, educated young men within Chamar community, had basically ensured that a community that was voting for the Congress Party, which had been historically, you know, at least in North India, you know, being the main political formation that would, you know, bring together different kinds of communities, especially, you know, upper castes and lower castes. But these educated young men had managed to basically convince the community to shift, you know, from the Congress Party to, you know, the Bahujan Samaj Party. So it was a very historical time, a very important moment. And that transition had already happened by the time I started my fieldwork. But what was very important was, tracing, all the reason as to why, you know, a party which was led by upper caste was no really longer, the best option, you know, for the very large, you know, Dalit vote banks, especially in North India. And so it was important to think about the ways in which Dalits would reflect upon this shift and the reasons as to why, you know, this shift was actually possible. And of course, you know, the BSP at that time was not just relying, though it was called, you know, it was known as to be like a Chamar party. And also the Chamar community is very large, you know, in Uttar Pradesh. It was not obviously just that. And over time, it managed, to successfully bring in more communities, including, upper caste communities. And we'll talk more, you know, about that during our conversation. But I think that it was a foundational moment. It was the time when, Dalit castes realized that they wanted to have, a political formation that was created and led by Dalits. And so it was an autonomous form of representation. And again, we always have to think that, relations between, Dalit castes and other caste groups is never really, always ideal and always benign. But within, this idea of, Bahujan Samaj, the majority of the People's Party, I think at least, as I said earlier, there was an hope and aspiration that those relations would be actually, peaceful, and, these political ideologies would bring together more people to find the hegemony of, the 1%, right, of the upper castes, within the state and beyond. And so it was kind of that moment of understanding that you could have your own political formation, you could elect representatives in the parliament, not just from the reserve constituencies that are in place in India, where only scheduled caste members can be elected by any party. Scheduled caste meaning Dalit, that's the legal denomination, but Dalit representatives or other lower caste representatives could be elected from any seat. And so as I think we'll discuss later on, this moment somehow it seems to have passed, and that's probably the kind of things that is important to reflect upon and to think about, of how those very amazing energies that were released by these political formations basically could not really have a life, more than just maybe a couple of decades, long. So that would be my reflection. But really, at the time that I was doing my fieldwork, I was really photographing the ascendance, the widening popularity of this party, and the kind of hope. The things would change also in terms, of course, of caste relations, not just in terms of development, because if you have caste violence, it's very difficult for, to improve your, the development index, human development index, for example, because, of course, you'll always have to face with marginalization, with, with violence, etc. So it was a moment of hope, which unfortunately did not, last till today, if you ask me. Thank you.
Thanks, Manuela. In fact, my next question is a follow-up to where you ended this question. And it's interesting that it has been almost 25 years of the work, since the work began. And so it's also interesting to locate your research in contemporary context. So in contemporary context, how do you see Chamar identity being rolled out in political sphere? Many of the criticism of BSP politics has discussed that BSP has turned into a Chamar Brahmin party rather than a Bahujan party as was proposed by Kanshiram. What is your critical reflection on this when you look back into your own work that you wrote almost a decade back and researched almost 25 years ago?
Yes, it's definitely following up on what we just discussed. And yes, there were very strong critiques about, this party, born as a Dalit party, created by Dalits, led by Dalits. But then, for reasons of, electoral calculus, basically, the party had to, strike alliances with upper caste parties. And and of course, coalitions, caste coalitions are incredibly potent, and nobody can actually, ignore them, right? But then again, you know, this was a short-lived somehow phase, you know, of the party. I mean, I'm talking about in historical terms, you know, where with reasons around, you know, sort of longer, you know, periods of time. And right now, it seems that, you know, the Dalit vote is increasingly being sort of absorbed by the Bharatiya Janata Party, right? Which is a party in power. And so there are a lot of questions about, you know, why this is actually happening. And I'm not talking about the community with whom I, you know, I conducted my fieldwork, you know, right now. You know, what basically brings, you know, a Dalit community or individuals, because, you know, it's also we have to differentiate, you know, because, of course, we are very attuned to the fact that very often communities vote in bloc. Right? But we also have to think of individuals, right? And we also have to think of a very important rural and urban, you know, sort of divide. So, you know, it's very interesting to reflect on as to why, you know, Dalits are increasingly voting for the Hindu right. But this is not also a new phenomenon, right? So there's, you know, the Dalit population, as you know, is a very diverse and heterogeneous, you know, population. And it's, you know, where there's many, many castes, you know, with very different histories and very different relations, you know, also among themselves. And so I think that this is really the question of the contemporary era, you know, thinking that, you know, Dalit parties are no longer in a way capable of you know, attracting, you know, the Dalit vote. We have, you know, Dalits voting, you know, for the Hindu right. What does that mean? You know, for, you know, thinking of Dalit movements in the past and in the present, there are basically pointing at Hinduism as the main sort of cause of, you know, their discrimination. And of course, we know very well, you know, the conversion, Dr. Ambedkar's conversion to Buddhism, and many Dalits did convert, of course, you know, to Buddhism. Though, for example, the community that I worked with, you know, that it was only like just few individuals who actually done that. So we also have to say this is also a diversity in terms of how Dalits, you know, relate, you know, with different, vis-a-vis different, you know, with different religious traditions within India. But really the question of, you know, today's question is, you know, why would you want to work for, would you want to vote for, you know, a Hindu right, you know, political party? But this is the reality that we are basically faced with, right? And so what does it mean, you know, for a Dalit basically to do that? It's about, you know, being included in a wider political vision, and what kind? Is it because the religious sort of component within this political formation is less relevant than other promises or other hopes? So this, I think, is the kind of question that is, you know, I would say very prominent, you know, today. But again, you know, it's not that it's a phenomenon only of today that, you know, Dalits have voted for, you know, Hindu right formations. But what we need to also confront with is, you know, why did this whole thing basically, why this, you know, Dalit parties, or especially, you know, the Bahujan Samaj Party, has, you know, basically almost faded from, you know, or lost a lot of, you know, electoral favor among Dalits. Why can't you promise, you know, things, you know, to them anymore? And what was the promise, you know? Was it only about sort of symbolic empowerment, or was it also about material empowerment, you know? So there's plenty of questions, you know, here. But really, we have, of course, you know, in front of us, we have a trend whereby, you know, we have, the Hindu Right Party increasingly, you know, getting increasingly powerful, and, you know, a Dalit Party that basically has lost, you know, quite a, you know, a lot of power and a lot of, votes, basically. So that's the kind of, maybe there's a lot of comparisons that we can make, you know, globally, but I think for the sake of the book, we probably want to stay here in a sense. Thank you.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, thanks, Manuela. That was really a helpful recontextualization of your work with contemporary context. And hopefully it will also help audiences to connect with the debates they might be witnessing around the Bahujan politics and the Dalit politics. So let me get back to some of the theoretical arguments that you have proposed in your book. So my next question is on that. So can you explain how the discourse of modernity be revisited through your ethnographic account of Chamar caste that you have discussed in your research? Also, if you can explain more about the theoretical reimagination of modernity that you have done and brought in your book. So can you reflect more on those lines?
Yes. So as we know, you know, modernity has been often theorized as the coming of a set of new practices, and also, also the coming of different ways in which people place themselves, you know, in time and space, especially in time. Okay, so that's what mainly interests me. During my field work, especially after, you know, when I was looking at what, you know, my data. Really, I wanted to, I ended up basically sort of breaking down this very unitary and very monolithic history of modernity in India through the tool of Chamar agency and identities. Okay, and so I was really thinking in terms of, you know, what does an elite, non-elite community, you know, bring to the table when we think of modernity? And that's what basically, what my intervention is really, all about. What does caste emancipation from caste bring to the table when we think of these both national, templates of modernity, you know, around the world, but also the specific national template, you know, within India? You know, what does it mean to foreground, you know, such communities and rethink modernity along these lines? Well, one of the main argument in the book is this, this dichotomy between past and present. And again, you know, I said this is a ways, you know, modernity is often being terrorized as, as featuring a certain experience of temporality. And so this was something that it was really so pervasive, you know, during my fieldwork. What was pervasive? You know, basically Chamars would value the present over the past, Okay. The past was always considered to be a very, they had a very derogatory notion of the past, because the past represented untouchability, basically, but also a lack of refinement of their own community. In the book, there is a chapter that was published as an article, that was titled, "In the past we were a bit chamars," and so you see, because chamar can in North India can also be, as you probably know, like a term of abuse, right? It does not just connote a caste name, but can also be a term of abuse. So it has to be used very carefully. And of course, I use it, in the book as a caste name, and of course, I dwell also on the politics of naming for those who are interested, right? And so there is this very strong notion of the past as something that you really want to overcome, okay? And so there's no such a thing as relying of, this idea of relying or reviving these traditions, because actually all it matters is the present, within this community. So the present becomes the temporality par excellence, right? Where the community has become, quote unquote, civilized, educated, where people can, no longer perform menial works, which is, of course, some people, of course, still did, where, the community mostly had emancipated from, agricultural labor, and also from, of course, upper caste landlords, which is very important. And so you see how this dichotomy between past and present as it emerged, from an ethnography with a non-elite community, poses a lot of questions about the sort of, national templates of modernity within India and maybe even, beyond. So this was really one of the main interventions, I think, that would reshape the discourse of modernity in India, but you can only do it if you choose a different standpoint, really. If you choose to foreground, the identity and practices of a non-elite community, and particularly like, a Dalit community, which has, and not only that community, but the whole population, which has, of course, a history of violence, discrimination, marginalization. Again, this, as I said earlier, the population, we are talking about over 200 million people. So we have a huge diversity, of course, within this population of histories, of, practices, and depending on, where they are located within India, et cetera, et cetera. So I would really, foreground the ways in which thinking of emancipation from caste and the kind of ideologies and techniques that each community has forged and has adopted over time is absolutely crucial to understand what modernity is all about. Okay, and there will be plural accounts. This is only one of the many accounts, but I hope that the kind of effort, this kind of effort is inspiring others to actually, search, push for difference, okay, further and further and further. And not, without relying only on this national, templates of modernity. And and see, obviously, what happens, in other communities. I mean, we mentioned, lower caste, community of the Yadu and the Ahirs, and we see difference there as well in the ways, they imagine their community. And there you see, they were very much, they very much crafted, these genealogies and also sacred genealogies, through the idiom of descent. So you see, the past there is a very important resource, unlike for the Chamars. And we are really talking about communities that, live in the same region. So I'm all in favor of pluralizing that discourse on modernity, because we would have, we would encounter so many different narratives. Yeah. So it's really about opening up the narratives, okay? Pluralizing the voices. Then if you ask me, you know, how this discourse, how these interventions, you know, can be maybe, I wouldn't say rethought, you know, like 10 or 20 years on, especially after these political hopes are a little, you know, have vanished, you know, to some extent, I was, you know, reminded of, you know, James Ferguson's work in Africa, where, you know, he basically was commenting on the development failure in the continent. And so something that had actually emptied modernity of that kind of theological element, i.e. progress will not come, will no longer materialize, okay? And so modernity changes from being sort of an aspiration towards the future, you know, and, you know, the hope that things will change, the hope that progress will come, into a status. Okay, so you are modern today, right? There's nothing that's going to come in the future. So you look at the present, you know, you have, of course, very dystopic, you know, landscape, but, you know, you can only rely on the present and claim, you know, a modern status for yourself, because that horizon of hope and progress has probably, you know, it's probably vanished forever. I mean, let's hope not forever, but that's the kind of thing we also have to think about in today's, you know, times. Who can give that hope? Who can give that promise? Yeah. And how that possible lack of, you know, horizon and, you know, hope in progress affects, you know, if we did, you know, the same ethnograph, not the same, you cannot do the same ethnographic fieldwork, you know, but, you know, ethnographic fieldwork with the same community, whether you would register that kind of, you know, loss of hope, loss of, you know, in progress and positive transformation. Because what was really crucial and what was really visible and important and pervasive, you know, during my fieldwork was this really, this very strong dichotomy between, you know, past and present. But would that be the same dichotomy as strong, you know, if we, you know, interview them today, you know, in changing and change, you know, political circumstances and development circumstances. So that's another open question, of course. But again, we have to also think of, you know, these other theoretical, you know, interventions, for example, you know, the one that I mentioned by Ferguson vis-a-vis the African continent. So I don't know whether this answer your, you know, your question.
Yes, Manuel, thank you for reflecting on what approach to modernity have you taken. And it's very interesting that you talk about a plural account of modernity and in fact modernities rather than working through a very national template of modernity. And in fact, this is very important to push ahead the differences that we see in the discourse of modernity itself. So moving on to a very similar question, my next question is that in your work, it is interesting to see how you have developed a dialectical relationship between Chamar community reflexive experience with modernity by analyzing their ethnos. How can we stretch this argument further to develop a knowledge paradigm? How can such form of knowledge further contribute to Dalit discourse?
Yes, that's great that you're asking me this question after all that we discussed so far. So I think that it's very clear from what we said and from the book that it's about, you know, the Dalit standpoint, okay, the Dalit Chamar standpoint, as vis-a-vis, you know, all kinds of other standpoints, and especially vis-a-vis the sort of normative caste standpoints, i.e., you know, upper caste, etc., you know. And this is a lens that has been often used to make sort of theoretical arguments about, you know, Indian history. I mean, not everything, but, you know, obviously, we always have to keep in mind that we want to challenge those, you know, normative standpoints, especially upper caste standpoints. So in addition to what I said, I mean, you're very right. I mean, I argue, you know, that actually this book was saturated with ethnos, but not only, of course, because we also talk about modernity. But the two things, you know, cannot really be, you know, we cannot really choose one or the other. And so you are still able to make a theoretical intervention and to think about, you know, these larger, you know, concepts by mobilizing basically the particular features of, you know, a community. And I think this is quite important. You know, we don't talk in abstract terms. We need to kind of, build on what, if that is our interest, of course, you know, at least it was mine for sure, you know, to think about what our interlocutors say and do and practice, to then, you know, think about these larger constructs, such as modernity. Now, I think that all of my work, you know, really starting with the article that preceded, you know, this book that were then included in the book, and then my subsequent work, and especially all the stuff that I published on, you know, BSP women activists, all this work basically has gone to basically contribute, I think, to the formation of a new knowledge paradigm. All these works actually say in direct and more direct and indirect ways, please open up the subject. Please don't consider Dalit communities, individuals, only as subjects of violence, discrimination, and marginalization, because only if you look at this book, right, there's so much more that comes into the picture, right? So, of course, we need to foreground, you know, Dalit experience, and I completely understand, you know, all of basically the very fierce and understandable desire to assert Dalit difference, especially, you know, in the younger generation of Dalit activists, because let's also think historically, you know, Dalit activism has also profoundly changed, you know, with the new generation of, you know, social media savvy, you know, young Dalits, which is actually great, both in India and in the diaspora. Okay. But all I've been trying to say, or a very important point that I've been trying to say with my work is, let's, you know, let's think of Dalit subjects as all-round subjects, right? There was one article actually that it was published in the Routledge Handbook of Gender in South Asia. And it's just been, the book has just been, you know, a new edition of the book has just been published. So I had this essay called, titled Dalit Women Between Social and Analytical Alternity, Rethinking the Quintessentially Marginal. Well, I think that this is where I, you know, I push in a more kind of direct way, you know, in towards this, you know, in this direction, like in the face of very active, you know, Dalit women in the public sphere, on the grounds, in the grassroots organizations, in political parties, can we think of them really only as, you know, quintessentially marginal subjects? And my answer is obviously no, right? Because we also want to know, you know, we also want to talk about, for example, Dalit women beyond, you know, exploitation, marginalization, and discrimination, because actually what we see in the public sphere and also in the private sphere, you know, is very different subjects, right? And this is not to depoliticize, of course, right? Dalit struggle for social equality and not for undermining an extremely long and rich history of, you know, anti-caste, you know, fights and struggles. But I think that, you know, it's very important to think of non-elites in the post-colonial world that are both very vocal and very active, you know, fighting historical injustices, but but also they are active doing other things, right? They're also active on everyday, in their everyday lives. They are, all I'm trying to say that I think that what I would like to see and what I've been striving for in my work is, you know, it's a knowledge paradigm where we consider, you know, Dalit communities, Dalit individuals, cross genders, across the gender spectrum as all around subjects. Okay. And so I think that the book is actually, it's a quite a good example, and also the subsequent writings in trying, you know, for trying and think of, you know, Dalit communities placed in much larger contexts and landscapes than just those of, you know, exploitation, marginalization, and discrimination. In my book, there's plenty of this, right? I mean, of course, you know, you've read the book, you know, so I'm not arguing for marginalizing. Of course, is in very an extremely important topic, and we, you know, unfortunately know more and more about, you know, what actually happens, you know, through social media, as opposed, for example, you know, at the time of my first field work, where surely, you know, violence would occur, but we would not be, I think, as, you know, informed, you know, about it. And that's the kind of big change that social media has brought about, as we all know, right? But really, I think that, you know, to get back to your question, I wish for this the Dalit discourse, both in India and globally, to really open up the subject, open up the agency, to open up identities, and, you know, pluralize voices as much as possible, and also to think of the historicity of all of this, right? Because as I said earlier, there's a kind of a big difference between how political agency was, you know, unfolded in a way, you know, in the previous generation and in this generation. Yeah. And so that also needs to be taken into account. So that would be my you know, my contribution and my hope, you know, for not only for Dalit discourse, but, you know, for any kind of, you know, analysis and conversation, you know, on and with, you know, Dalit individuals and communities. So I hope this reply answers your question.
Thank you, Manva, so much for talking about what Dalit knowledge means and how far the Dalit discourse can be discussed and in ways in which it can further unfold. So towards the end, I would like to ask, is there any concluding remarks that you would like to talk about your book? And also, how do you see to take your work, Retro-Modern India, forward?
Right. Well, I should say that, thank you so much. And I should say that, you know, there's hopefully I will manage a second edition of this book where all of these thoughts, reflections, and additional, you know, work that has been accumulated over the years, you know, can find the space. And so, you know, that is my hope and aspiration, you know, that I managed to actually do this. So there's you know, maybe, what I'm hoping, you know, like in a new publication that can bring all of these together. But I think that, see, one of the main things, as I said earlier, is, you know, one of the main changes to ethnographic fieldwork in general, but also especially thinking of what the kind of ethnographic fieldwork that I've conducted, you know, in UP, in Uttar Pradesh, you know, with this community, is really how, you know, is social media, right? And so, you know, one of my questions is always, okay, what if I was conducting, you know, field work with them, you know, at this time? And I think what is actually amazing is the ways in which I can connect with this community. And I've been in touch, you know, over the years with them, even with video calls, you know, when there is a celebration with, you know, photographs, etc. And of course, I did not take many, you know, photographs at that time. Of course, some, you know, I have, but it's the kind of, visual, textual, you know, accounts, you know, that, you know, might come together today that probably we, you know, and the kind of, you know, different forms of communication, you know, that social media allows. So I think that that's the kind of curiosity that I have, you know, it's the kind of, you know, my own aspiration, you know, to be able to really think again about, you know, these, you know, this fieldwork and these communities, think, you know, bringing in all that, you know, the good and the bad, I would say, you know, that social media has basically brought into the, brought into the picture. And I'm actually going to write just a little preview. I'm going to write, you know, as part of a panel for it's the film festival of the Royal Anthropological Institute that is going to happen next spring. I'm actually going to write a piece on, you know, the Dalit image, precisely basing myself on, you know, basing this on, you know, my strong interest in thinking of visuality, vision, and image vis-a-vis, you know, Dalit communities in this era. So you see, I've been writing about, you know, sort of many things, but this kind of question has remained with me. And so let's see what comes out, you know, in the future, you know, while pursuing this this question. Of course, a lot of this interest has been influenced by my research work on the politics of art and materiality in India, as you know, with the over 10 years I've been working on this. And so the two kind of major strands of my work are coming together and they're mutually enriching and, you know, one another. And so that's also, you know, something that I, you know, some tools and you know, conceptual frameworks that, of course, I didn't have and I wasn't aware at the time because, of course, this other newer work, let's call it this way, you know, hadn't taken place. And so, you know, right now I can build, you know, I can mobilize and I can capitalize on many more things than 25 years ago, of course. I mean, it goes without saying, but I'm very much looking forward to developing basically this other strands of work. Oh, thank you.
Thank
so
you,
much.
Manuela. Thank you, Manuela. That was indeed very good reflection on your work. And I'm sure this podcast will be helping a lot of people who read your work ahead and engage with the Dalit discourse in the coming times. So thanks again, Manuela, for talking to us at the New Books Network. And hope to have further discussions with you again over your new projects. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kalyani. Very kind and very nice of you of, you know, like thinking of my book. And I'm very much looking forward to talking more with you about the future projects and your own projects, of course. Thank you so much.